bankrupted it. It runs a tracking program to identify hate groups, track whether they're growing or shrinking. They did this after January 6th. They had been tracking the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, the foot soldiers of the violence of January 6th. Remember, the Proud Boys are the ones that Donald Trump himself, when he ran for president, told to stand by as if they were at his command, and that was before January 6, 2021. The Unite the Right rally was the very rally that Donald Trump had said they're good and bad people on both sides when they were chanting, Jews will not replace us, when their links to anti-Semitism, neo-Nazism, and white supremacy was clear. And this, the reason I'm saying this is what Southern Poverty Law Center has done is, in addition to ensuring that people know about their rights to vote, in addition to fighting for voting rights in the South, in addition to doing all the things it can to ensure that people have a voice about whether or not they can see a doctor when they're sick, or whether or not they have a fair wage for the work they do, that the other thing they do is track hate in this country. But that has exposed allies of Donald Trump. It has exposed people who are in its administration. It has exposed the very connections that he himself has publicly stated, or that people he is in close relationship have publicly been seen in relationship with. The reason I say all of that is because when Todd Blanche, I stand by them because I know what this is. It's political persecution, because you have some power of advocacy in voice around the very civil rights we have been fighting for in this country, so that we have a democracy that serves all our needs. And they track hate across the board, not with political ideology other than whether it's extremism. And it matters so much because we're watching a politics that is trying to erase the fact that racism exists. Todd Blanche, on announcing this indictment, said it out loud. He said, they're trying to say that racism is real when it's not. That's basically what he says. Those aren't his words, but those were the import of his words. Donald Trump has publicly said that the civil rights laws hurt white men. That's actually a white nationalist trope and talking point. Not to mention how many times we've seen white supremacy and neo-Nazism, the rise of hate and anti-Semitism in this country. SPLC's been fighting it. So all I can say is there's a pattern in the development of tyranny in countries across the globe where the person who wants to have that power finds ways to discredit the lawful advocacy of organizations that are fighting to ensure that democracy survives. But democracy doesn't survive in lies, and everything we just heard was a lie.
We just have 10 seconds. Do you think other groups are next? You represent scores of groups similar to the SPLC.
We've had hundreds of organizations refuse to be afraid of this administration weaponizing government against lawful activity. Hundreds have. But the reason, one of the reasons, is because everyone understands that this administration has been signaling in multiple ways that it is going to find ways to punish anyone it disagrees with. So, yes, I expect that we will see this audition from Todd Blanche to be the people's lawyer is Todd Blanche's audition to show, I'll go after anyone you want me to because we don't like them.
Maya Wiley, I want to thank you for being with us, President and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, ran for mayor in 2021. Coming up, Lebanese-born academic Joubert Achkar on the wars in Iran and Lebanon and President Trump's embrace of gunboat diplomacy. Back in 30 seconds.
Midnight blue gave way to a day. Trying to act right in a trench coat of selves. Find some meaning in a poem or proverb. want to feel mercy in the dawn. Sun's taking credit.
Mercy by Minneapolis jazz musician and songwriter Sophia Shorai. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
President Trump said Wednesday the U.S. will continue its naval blockade of Iran until Tehran makes an agreement over its nuclear program. Trump's comments to Axios raised the prospect that the Strait of Hormuz could remain closed for months, setting off panic in global energy markets. Axios is also reporting that President Trump is slated to receive a briefing today on plans for new potential military action in Iran from CENTCOM Commander Admiral Brad Cooper. This comes as the U.S. blockade and U.S.-Israeli attacks have pushed Iran into a severe economic crisis, with the cost of food and medicine skyrocketing. Meanwhile, Israeli airstrikes and controlled demolitions in Lebanon are ongoing. More than 1.2 million people have been displaced. Earlier this week, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said, quote, "The fate of southern Lebanon will be the same as that of Gaza."
To discuss this and more, we're joined by the longtime scholar of the region, Gilbert Achecar, emeritus professor at SOAS, the University of London. His article from earlier this year in Le Monde Diplomatique is headlined U.S., an old new imperial doctrine. His latest book, Gaza Catastrophe, the Genocide and World Historical Perspective. Gilbert Achecar, thanks so much for joining us today. If you could start off by explaining exactly what you mean by the new old imperial doctrine.
Yes, good morning, Amy and Nermeen. Very great to be with you, despite the very sad character of the times we're going through. I've been listening to the program from the beginning. It's really demoralizing. Anyway... Right. It's an old new imperial doctrine in the sense that the basics of imperialism are still at work, but with the shifts over the time. If you compare to the George W. Bush era, when a regime change was on the order of the day through the invasion of Iraq with the pretension of bringing democracy to that country. Well, that's one thing that Donald Trump cannot be accused of, which is the claim of bringing democracy anywhere, right? So that's definitely not his cup of tea. And instead of that, he is just going back to 19th century gunboat diplomacy. You bomb a country until they submit, until you get them doing what you want. Now, he had a success in this kind of policy in Venezuela after abducting the president's country. And he believed very stupidly, very short-sightedly, that the same could be repeated by just decapitating the Iranian regime. And the result is definitely the most botched up of all U.S. imperial wars in history. I mean, I can't think of any other failure in planning, any other degree of wishful thinking into getting into a war. And actually, he got exactly the contrary of what he was pursuing in some sense. He believed that the pragmatist in the Iranian regime would take over after his military action. Well, the result has been exactly the contrary. It's very clearly just enhanced the militarization of the regime. It enhanced the Revolutionary Guard Corps, And if you compare with the, I mean, whatever one thinks of Barack Obama's policy on the matter, but the deal he did with Iran strengthened the hand of the reformists in the Iranian regime. You had Hassan Rouhani as president, and he stayed there for several years. But then came Donald Trump, who just removed all that. The result has been Iran going back to uranium enrichment and increasing it tremendously, and the hardliners taking over. So that's the most counterproductive policy ever. I mean, this belief that the big stick will work everywhere is just so short-sighted.
And Professor Ashkar, I want to ask about what you think led the U.S. in to this war. You've said, you know, that some commentary, which suggests erroneously, in your view, that it was Israel that forced the U.S. into this war. You said in an interview recently, quote, conservatives such as John Mearsheimer, Stephen Walt, and the wing of the MAGA sphere represented by Tucker Carlson tried to obscure the reality of U.S. imperialism and attribute its failures to the Israel lobby, if not to the, quote, Jews, as in the case of Tucker Carlson. So if you could elaborate on that and explain why this argument could even plausibly be made.
Sure, Nermeen. I mean, this is the game of blame it on Israel, if not blame it on the Jews, as you said. And I mean, it strikes me that this began with the failed Iraq invasion of 2003. Mearsheimer didn't say the same of the bombing of Iraq, the turning of Iraq into the Stone Age, as the UN report said, in 1991. Because he believed probably that that was a success. So this idea of blaming U.S. failures on Israel or anyone else is indeed an attempt to blur the reality of U.S. imperialism. And let me tell you one thing. It is, I mean, absolutely obvious to me that for Donald Trump, for Kushner, Jared Kushner, for Steve Witkoff, the Gulf monarchies are much more important than whatever Israel can represent. I mean, that's where their economic interests are. That's where they have billions of dollars of joint investments and the rest. And therefore, I mean, of course, the United States has used the Israeli military, who was only very happy to oblige, in this joint war on Iran. But you could see, everyone could see how when Donald Trump decided that he had to stop, he did not even consult Netanyahu, although Netanyahu has been on his side from day one. So, I mean, no, these wars are U.S. imperialist wars. You can have a convergence with the Zionist state on this or that issue, but basically the key driving force for the United States is U.S. imperialism, U.S. capitalism, key interests of the United States, and not Israel. This is just a very misleading interpretation of facts.
Professor Ashkar, finally, you know, now it's been 2 months since this war began, and it appears now that no end is in sight. There were talks in Islamabad and Pakistan recently, but they seem to be almost entirely at an impasse. So if you could explain, what are the objectives now of the two parties, and what are the points of difference?
Right. I would first say that I'm not sure that Donald Trump himself knows exactly where he wants to go. I mean, the stated objectives on the U.S. side are the abandonment by Iran of nuclear enrichment, That's the major stated goal of the Trump administration. And on that, the Iranian side has been quite steadfast, refusing the idea of having to stop this uranium enrichment, even though, I mean, there are a lot of reports pointing to the fact of disagreements within the Iranian regime between the pragmatists who believe that Iran could just abandon this nuclear enrichment if it gets in exchange a full removal of all sanctions and a real economic opening. The military side, the hardliners in the Iranian regime, don't see it that way. Their raison d'être is basically war, you know. And I made a comparison in that regard between the Russian model and the Chinese model recently. Iran is closer to the Russian model of a combination of militarization and rent economy, oil rent, fossil fuel rent, instead of what the pragmatists there would like, which would be some kind of imitation of the Chinese model of economic opening and, let's say, more peaceful relation with the rest of the world.
Jaber Ashkar, we want to thank you so much for being with us, Emeritus Professor at SOAS, University of London. We're going to link to your article, U.S., an Old New Imperial Doctrine, in Le Monde Diplomatique, his latest book, As a Catastrophe, the Genocide in World Historical Perspective. Coming up, the Iran war is another reason to quit oil. We'll speak with climate activist and author Bill McKibben. Stay with us. Minneapolis jazz musician and songwriter Sophia Shorai. I'll be in Minneapolis with the film Steal the Story, Please, on May 8th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to climate change. Last month was the warmest March on record in over 130 years in the United States. An average rainfall across the country is at a record low so far this year. The dry conditions are fueling wildfires across Georgia and Florida ahead of what is expected to be a very hot summer. And now the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, is predicting a likely super El Nino weather pattern to begin later this year through 2027, further driving up average global temperatures. Meanwhile, new research has found that a major ocean circulatory system in the Atlantic, known as Amak, is in danger of weakening to the point of collapse faster and sooner than previously thought. The Amak system, which includes the Gulf Stream, helps distribute heat around the planet. Its collapse could have catastrophic consequences. Scientists are now concerned the tipping point could be reached as early as the middle of this century. But despite overwhelming scientific consensus, the United States, the world's largest historical emitter of greenhouse gases, is moving away from taking the threat seriously. This is President Trump earlier this month at a Talking Point USA rally in Phoenix.
The Green News scam, one of the greatest scams in history, remember? Climate change, global warming, all of this. They actually had global warming. Remember that that wasn't working because we were actually cooling as a planet. And then they just said, climate change, because climate change takes care of heat, snow, whatever you have.
That was President Trump speaking at Turning Point. Despite this, the energy crisis caused by the war in Iran is underscoring the economic and security benefits of transitioning away from fossil fuels and towards renewable alternatives. For more on all of this, we're joined by climate activist and author Bill McKibben. His recent article in The New Yorker magazine is headlined, "The Iran War is Another Reason to Quit Oil." Bill McKibben's co-founder of 350.org and Third Act, joining us here in our New York studio. Welcome back, Bill, to Democracy Now! If you can talk about what the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran means for the climate.
Well, what it means for energy policy is that everyone around the world can suddenly see the utter folly of relying on a fuel that not only is destroying the planet's climate, but also that can be bottled up behind a 20-mile-long waterway. I mean, sunlight has to travel 93 million miles to reach the Earth, but none of those miles go through the Strait of Hormuz. That makes it a very appealing alternative, especially now that it's cheaper than burning coal and gas and oil. So the movement in the last month has been pretty remarkable around much of the world in the direction of what we used to call alternative energy. The only place that's not happening, of course, is here at home.
And could you explain? I mean, first of all, the U.S. now produces the most oil in the world. So how does that play into this?
Well, Pete Hegseth said the other day that there were tankers lining up outside the Texas Ship Channel to get good old American crude. It's true that in the short run, this will probably be a bonus for the big American oil companies whose profits are through the roof and who, by the way, should be paying a serious windfall profits tax in any serious government. But over the slightly longer term, what we're seeing is demand destruction around the planet. Look, the forecast for how American oil companies were going to stay rich and prosperous for the next couple of decades pretty much depended on everybody in Asia deciding they were going to drive gasoline-powered pickup trucks. That's not what's happening. Instead, people are crowding into the showrooms of companies like BYD, the Chinese EV giant, because they don't want to pay. I mean, we're paying $4 and $5 for gas. It's much higher in much of Asia, which is, you know, where this story will be decided. Would that we were doing all this for climate reasons. I mean, we're meeting right now, or just finished this big meeting in Santa Marta in Colombia, with many nations trying to work towards a fossil fuel phase out on climate grounds. That isn't happening anywhere near fast enough. A bigger catalyst at the moment is the clear geopolitical imperative to get off fossil fuel while you can.
So talk about where you're seeing this around the world. As you say, in fact, countries are running to this as the U.S. administration is running away from this.
The president of South Korea said the other day that he wasn't able to sleep at night trying to figure out where they were going to find energy supplies. The place they're going to find them, he said, is homegrown energy. Indonesia, which is going to be one of the most important powers in the world, announced within days of the start of hostilities that they were going to put 100 gigawatts worth of solar on their grid in the next few years. Everybody's figuring out that it is ludicrous to be exposed any more than you have to the completely volatile and undependable supply of fossil fuel when, you know, the sun rises pretty much every morning.
And if you could explain to your point, you know, the argument here is that, you know, renewables are too expensive, they take too long. But China, meanwhile, has built so much clean energy very, very quickly. It's a world leader in clean energy investment. installation and manufacturing. How did that happen?
Well, the Chinese decided that this was going to be the strategic imperative, and so they got to work. And they've driven the price down so far. This is by far, that we live on a planet where the cheapest way, Nermeen, to produce energy is to point a sheet of glass at the sun. That's been true now for 3 or 4 years, and it's showing up in the fact that 95% of new electric generation around the planet last year came from the sun and the wind. Now, the U.S. is the exception to that. Even here, though, we're seeing continued investment in this stuff just because of economics. The state where it's growing the fastest is that radical progressive hub, Texas. And at Third Act, we've been having lots of luck this spring in state legislatures around the country, getting them to approve this so-called balcony solar or plug-in solar. That's the very easiest, cheapest way for apartment dwellers and others to get in on this burgeoning revolution.
Bill, we just have 2 minutes, and I want to get to the El Nino and the possible collapse of this AMOC, the Atlantic Ocean Circulation System, what this means.
Nothing good. When I wrote The End of Nature 40 years ago, this was one of the things that we were talking about as a possible result of climate change. As you melt, as fresh water pours off a melting Greenland, it changes the salinity and hence the density of seawater in the North Atlantic. That density drives this giant heat distribution engine, the biggest on the planet. If it collapses, as the chief scientist on this work now said is at least a 50% possibility this century, then it's a civilizational scale event. Temperatures plummet across Western Europe. Sea levels rise sharply and quickly along the eastern U.S. But basically, we add, 30 or 40 parts per million CO2 almost immediately to the atmosphere as CO2 leaves the ocean. These are the kind of things that they make science fiction thrillers about. It would be the biggest single event in the history of our species. We want to avoid it at all costs. The main tool that we have right now to do that is the very rapid deployment of clean energy.
The last 30 seconds. Are you hopeful?
I'm hopeful that we actually have a tool, finally, to put to work. We're not going to stop global warming, Amy. We may be able to start shaving tenths of a degree off how hot the planet gets, and that would, at the very least, be helpful.
Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, founder of the organization Third Act. His latest book, Here Comes the Sun, A Last Chance for the Climate and a Fresh Chance for Civilization. We'll link to your article, The Iran War is Another Reason to Quit Oil. That does it for our show. I'll be in Boston tonight in Brookline for screenings of the new documentary about Democracy Now! Steal This Story, Please. It's showing at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline. Then on Friday, May 1st and Saturday, I'll be in Silver Spring, Maryland at 2 benefit screenings, one for WHUT, Howard University PBS, and the other for WPFW Pacifica Radio. See democracynow.org for more information about these calendars. Then we'll be at the Charles Theater in Baltimore. And on Sunday, we'll be in Philadelphia doing a fundraiser for PhillyCam. That's Philadelphia Public Access. Again, you can go to democracynow.org for all details. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Nina Gesder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Teresaina, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Turnin, Vera Samoff, K. Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Honey, Masu Diego Ramos. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, B.C.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.
You have tuned in to Open Mic on CJSF Radio, broadcasting on 90.1 FM from Burnaby Mountain, BC.